You ever look at a Spitfire and wonder where those curves came from? That elliptical wing, that narrow fuselage, the way the whole airplane looks like it was poured instead of bolted together. Well, pull up a chair, because the answer is not what you might expect. It starts with a wealthy Frenchman, a trophy made of silver, and a bunch of seaplanes screaming across the water at speeds nobody thought possible. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So, 1912, a French industrialist and aviation enthusiast named Jacques Schneider, heir to a steel and armaments fortune, had a vision. He believed the future of aviation was over water. Think about it from his perspective. In 1912, there were almost no paved runways. Fields were muddy. Landing gear collapsed. But water was everywhere, flat, long, and forgiving. Schneider figured that if you could build a fast, reliable seaplane, you could connect the cities of the world using harbors and rivers and coastlines that already existed. So he put up a trophy. The Coupe d'Aviation Maritime Jacques Schneider. A gorgeous piece of silver and bronze sculpture depicting the spirit of flight kissing the waves, and he attached a prize of 25,000 francs to it. The rules were straightforward. Each nation could enter up to 3 aircraft. The course was over water. Any nation that won the trophy 3 times in 5 years would keep it permanently, and that last detail, that permanent possession clause, turned what could have been a polite little competition into a full-blown international arms race. The first race was held in 1913 at Monaco. 4 aircraft entered. Only one finished. A Frenchman named Maurice Prévost nursed a little Depardieu monoplane around the course at about 45 miles per hour. Not exactly thrilling by today's standards, but something had started.
The Great War interrupted things, as it tended to do. But when the races resumed in 1919, the machines were different. Wartime had pushed engine technology forward by a decade in 4 years. Suddenly, these were not fragile stick-and-fabric contraptions puttering over the harbor. These were purpose-built racing machines with engines that would have seemed like fantasy just a few years earlier. Through the early 20s, the Italians and the British traded victories back and forth. The Americans got into it too. In 1923, the United States Navy entered a team flying Curtiss CR-3 biplanes, and Lieutenant David Rittenhouse won the race at Cowes, England, at an average speed of just under 178 miles per hour. A seaplane, on floats. Going 178. That was faster than most land-based fighters of the era. Now here's where it gets interesting. The Schneider Trophy was not just about speed, it was about national prestige, and the money flowing into these programs was staggering. Italy had Mussolini's personal backing. The Italian team was run by the Regia Aeronautica, and their aircraft were designed by a brilliant engineer named Mario Castoldi. His Mach-E racing floatplanes were works of art, bright red, impossibly streamlined, with enormous engines crammed into the smallest possible airframes. The Italians won in 1926 at Hampton Roads, Virginia, flying a Mach-E M39 at an average of nearly 247 miles per hour. But across the English Channel, a quiet, methodical Englishman was watching. His name was Reginald Joseph Mitchell, R.J. Mitchell. He was the chief designer at the Supermarine Aviation Works in Southampton, and he had been designing flying boats and floatplanes since he was 24 years old. Mitchell was not flashy. He did not give speeches or court the press. He solved problems with pencil and paper and wind tunnel data, and an almost obsessive attention to aerodynamic efficiency. Mitchell had designed the Supermarine S5 for the 1927 race at Venice. The S5 was a low-wing monoplane with a Napier Lion engine, producing about 900 horsepower. It was clean, it was fast, and Flight Lieutenant Sidney Webster flew it to victory at nearly 282 miles per hour. Britain had its first win. The next race was in 1929, at Calshot on the Solent. And this is where the story takes a turn that shaped the next half century of aviation. Mitchell designed the Supermarine S6, but the airplane was only half the equation. The other half was the engine, and for that, Mitchell turned to Rolls-Royce. Rolls-Royce had been building aero engines since the First World War, but the Schneider Trophy program pushed them into territory they had never imagined. The engine they developed for the S6 was called the R, just the letter R. It was a supercharged V12 producing about 1,900 horsepower from a displacement of just under 37 liters. To put that in perspective, a typical car engine of the era made maybe 40 horsepower. This thing made 1,900. The engineering challenges were enormous. Cooling, fuel delivery. The sheer mechanical stress of spinning a propeller at those speeds while mounted on floats bouncing across the Solent. Flying Officer Henry Waghorn won the 1929 race in the S6 at just under 329 miles per hour. Britain had its second consecutive win, one more, and the trophy would be theirs permanently, but then the money ran out. 1931. The Great Depression had its grip on the world. The British government announced it could not justify funding a racing program when people were struggling to eat. The Schneider Trophy defense was canceled, and this is the moment that changes everything. A private citizen stepped in, Lady Lucy Houston, one of the wealthiest women in Britain, a fiery, patriotic eccentric who had already made headlines for her political views and her charitable giving, wrote a check for £100,000. In 1931 money, that was a fortune. She did it, she said, because she would not see Britain humiliated by failing to defend its own trophy. With Lady Houston's money, Rolls-Royce went back to the workshop. They squeezed the R engine up to 2,400 horsepower. Mitchell refined the S6 into the S6B, cleaning up every surface, reducing every source of drag he could find. The team had less than a year to prepare.
September 13, 1931. Calshot, England. The weather was hazy. The Solent was choppy. Flight Lieutenant John Boothman climbed into the cockpit of the Supermarine S6B, registration S1695, and took off. The Italians and the French had both withdrawn. Mechanical problems, insufficient funding, development delays. Boothman flew the course alone, but he flew it at 340.08 miles per hour. The trophy was Britain's, permanently. 2 weeks later, on September 29th, Flight Lieutenant George Stainforth took the same type of aircraft up for a straight-line speed record attempt and hit 407.5 miles per hour. A seaplane, on floats, over 400 miles per hour, in 1931. Now, you might be thinking, that is a fine racing story, tail dragger. But what does this have to do with the Spitfire? Everything. Everything has to do with the Spitfire. R.J. Mitchell had spent nearly a decade designing the fastest seaplanes in the world. He had learned things about wing design, about radiator placement, about the relationship between power and drag that no textbook could teach. When the Air Ministry issued specification F7/30 for a new single-seat fighter in 1934, Mitchell did not start from scratch. He started from the Schneider racers. The elliptical wing of the Spitfire, people assume it was purely an aerodynamic choice, and it was, partly. The elliptical planform distributes lift more efficiently than a straight or tapered wing, but Mitchell had also learned from the Schneider floatplanes that a thin wing section was critical for high-speed flight. The Spitfire's wing was remarkably thin for a fighter of its era, and that thinness came directly from the racing experience. The Rolls-Royce Merlin engine that powered the Spitfire. It was a direct descendant of the R engine, same basic V12 configuration, same supercharging philosophy. The engineers who had pushed the R to 2,400 horsepower on a test stand learned lessons about metallurgy, about cooling jacket design, about supercharger impeller geometry that went straight into the Merlin's development. The Merlin started the war producing about 1,000 horsepower. By 1945, late Mark Merlins were making over 1,700. And the foundation for all of that had been laid on the shores of the Solent, trying to win a silver trophy. Even the Spitfire's cooling system bore the Schneider Trophy's fingerprints. On the racing floatplanes, Mitchell had experimented with surface radiators, where the coolant flowed through channels built into the skin of the wings and fuselage. You could not hang a big frontal radiator on a racing seaplane and expect to win. That thinking led to the Spitfire's distinctive underwing radiator design, tucked into a carefully shaped duct that actually produced a small amount of thrust from the heated air exiting the back. A racing trick adapted for war. R.J. Mitchell did not live to see what his fighter became. He died of cancer in 1937. At the age of 42, he saw the prototype fly. He knew it was good. But he never saw a Spitfire in combat. He never saw the Battle of Britain. He never knew that the airplane born from his racing seaplanes would become the symbol of a nation's survival. There is a direct line, an unbroken thread, from Maurice Prevost puttering around Monaco Harbor at 45 miles per hour in 1913 to a young RAF pilot pulling into a high G-turn over Kent in the summer of 1940, trying to get a deflection shot on a Messerschmitt. The Schneider Trophy races were the laboratory, the seaplanes were the prototypes, and every lesson learned at 300 miles per hour over the water paid dividends at 350 miles per hour over England when it mattered most. Jacques Schneider died in 1928. He never saw the final race, he never saw the Spitfire, but his vision, his belief that competition would drive innovation, that national pride would push engineers past what seemed possible, was proven right in ways he could not have imagined. The trophy itself sits today in the Science Museum in London. It is a beautiful piece of sculpture,
But the real legacy is not in the silver, it is in the curves of an elliptical wing, in the growl of a Merlin engine, in the fact that a seaplane racing series, funded at the last moment by one stubborn woman's check, helped save a country.
That story comes from Ralph Barker's book on the Schneider Trophy races, from the Supermarine Archives at the Solent Sky Museum in Southampton, and from the Royal Air Force Museum's records on the US-6B program. You can find more at radiohangar.com. Fly safe out there. And next time you see a Spitfire, remember it started on floats.